All right, let's begin the reading of today's Boston Herald for this Friday, the 12th of June, 2026, on the Talking Information Center. And we say hello to Bob and Donnie.
We have three front page stories for you to start off with today. Our first one, monster guilty. Jury convicts serial rapist Alvin Campbell. Coward Campbell, 21 times guilty. And this is by Colleen Cronin. A jury handed down guilty verdicts on 21 of 22 charges faced by serial rapist Alvin Campbell, including aggravated rape and kidnapping charges, at Suffolk Superior Court yesterday after deliberating for the better part of a week. Judge Mary Ames said that the jury was deadlocked on a rape charge and declared a mistrial on that single count. It took the clerk and jury foreman several minutes to go through the charges. Campbell was found guilty on three counts of aggravated rape, four counts of rape, two counts of kidnapping, three counts of indecent assault and battery on a person over 14, one count of assault with intent to rape, seven counts of recording a nude person, and one count of photographing an unsuspecting nude person. Before the verdicts were read, Ames warned audience members not to react, telling them to avoid making gestures or facial expressions, and there was little reaction in the courtroom, with court officers surrounding the defendant. He bit his lip as the jury repeated, "Guilty." Afterwards, Campbell's attorney, Andrew Carosi, asked if they could be polled, which would have required each member of the jury to be asked to individually answer for each count. Ames said she saw, quote, absolutely no manifestations of dissent among the jurors, and told Carosi, "Your request is denied." She thanked the jury for their service. She said that early on in their deliberations, the jury had struggled to come to a consensus on the last count of rape, spending 8 hours total on the charge and still coming out deadlocked. Ames called their efforts thorough and deliberate before declaring the mistrial. "I want to thank these jurors for taking the long time they took," Suffolk County District Attorney Kevin Hayden said. "Clearly it took them some time to get through it all, but we're glad we came back with the decisions they did on most of the counts and almost all of them." The jury determined that Alvin Campbell was what our prosecutions presented in court, Hayden continued, "a man who cunningly, deceivingly, and calculatedly preyed upon women in their most vulnerable moments." Campbell, the older brother of State Attorney General Andrea Campbell, was originally arrested in 2020 after a victim came forward to say that a man posing as her Uber driver had kidnapped and raped her. Prosecutors built a case around the theory that Campbell had been posing as a rideshare driver to prey on extremely drunk young women coming out of Boston bars. After the first woman came forward, officers found photos and videos of other women and filed more charges against him. During the trial, Suffolk County Assistant District Attorneys Aaron Murphy and Lynn Feigenbaum shared videos of sex acts and stills of women appearing to be passed out. Several of the victims took the stand, talk about how intoxicated they were prior to the encounters and what little they remembered from them. But his defense had argued that the encounters Campbell had with the women were consensual, and that even though they may have been drunk at the time, they were not incapacitated. When cross-examined, the women, Carosi drew on moments when it appeared before and after that they were flirting or being nice to Campbell to try to show that the women had wanted to and did engage in the acts. The trial lasted over 2 weeks, with the jury getting the case a week ago. Following the verdict, Murphy and Feigenbaum declined to pursue habitual offender enhancements, which would have created a separate proceeding. Aggravated rape carries a sentence of up to life in the state of Massachusetts. Campbell will be sentenced on June 29th. Dottie?
Thanks, Bob. And now another front page story. Southie lemonade stand robbed. Lemonade stand robbed at gunpoint by Flint McColgan. Boston police are investigating two pint-sized hoodlums suspected of putting the squeeze on a children's lemonade stand in Southie at gunpoint. There is little I can think of more disturbing than the innocence of a children's lemonade stand being violated by an armed robbery, Boston City Councilor Ed Flynn, who represents portions of South Boston, said after learning of the crime. When something as serious as this happens, we cannot downplay or ignore it. As a city, we have to finally acknowledge we have serious public safety issues in Boston. We desperately need more police officers and to redouble our community policing efforts, Flynn continued. Boston police responded to a report of an armed robbery at 157 West 9th Street in South Boston at around 4:45 p.m. Wednesday, according to the police report. There, they met up with the child victims, who were now with their father. The children said that two boys had, I quote, made several passes by the lemonade stand before they approached and asked whether or not they would accept Apple Pay, end of quote, according to the report. Before the young lemonade entrepreneurs could respond, however, the child robbers grabbed the stand's cash box, which contained about $50 in cash, and one of the suspects flashed a black handgun before the pair ran off. The children described the suspects according to the report. One was described as a dark-skinned black male, about 14 years old, wearing a black Nike shisty black shirt, unknown color shorts, and high white socks. This suspect displayed a black firearm in his waistband. The second suspect was described as a light-skinned black male, about 11 years old, with a black shisty and unknown clothing description. A shisty is apparently a term for a balaclava, or full face covering, according to images of the clothing on Nike's website. The children told police that the suspects had run off toward West 9th Street before reaching Dorchester Street. The local police intelligence agency, the Boston Regional Intelligence Center, says its cameras did not face toward the incident. Police ask that anyone with any information regarding these suspects contact detectives at 617-343-4742. Or submit information anonymously through the Crime Stoppers tip line by calling 1-800-494-TIPS, or it's 8477, or texting the word TIP to crime The numbers are 27463. Bob?
Thank you, Dottie. And our last front page story, so subtitled from the front page, Crunch Time, High School Tourney Action. And there's three stories that I'll just cut them short. I won't read the whole story, but you'll get the idea. It's an exciting time of year for high school sports. First one, high school girls lacrosse. Morrison Stutzman to help deliver history for Sandwich. And this is by Brendan Connolly. Dateline Wellesley. The game was hanging in the balance, and the temperatures were oppressive. However, as they have done time and time again this season, Sandwich's Paige Morrison, Elizabeth Stutzman, and their teammates came through in the clutch, and they accomplished history Thursday. Morrison sniped the eventual game-winning goal, while Stutzman registered a hat trick as top-seeded Sandwich captured its first-ever girls lacrosse state title with an epic 9-6 victory over number 2 Ipswich in the Division 4 final. "It honestly feels unreal and amazing," Stutzman said. "I know how hard we work throughout every season. We just keep getting better and better. And finally, well, this was our year." Both schools entered the championship motivated. After many promising playoff runs in recent years, Sandwich, 20-3, was taking part in its first final. Meanwhile, Ipswich, 17-4, reached the Division IV title game twice in the past 4 years, 2023 and 2024, only to come up short. Not to mention the Tigers were also eagerly looking to bring home a title after the dramatic events of the past week impacting many of their classmates with the school's boys lacrosse team. And our next, our next one, Dynasty. Belmont captured 9th consecutive state crown. And this is from Jack Murray. Dateline Quincy, the threat was real, but Belmont knew what to do. A 3-try performance from Rebecca Christensen and consistent play all throughout the field helped Belmont claim a 36-24 victory over Weymouth to win the girls' rugby state championship at Veterans Memorial Stadium. This was the Marauders' 9th consecutive championship, which is also every year that the girls' rugby has been an MIAA-sponsored sport. And the last one, high school boys' rugby, three-peat. BC High tops Milton to grab another Division I title. This is from Jack Murray. Dateline Quincy calls it a championship tradition. Through aggressive defending and timely offense, BC High rugby defeated Milton 48-10 to win the MIAA Division I Boys Rugby State Championship at Veterans Memorial Stadium. This was the 3rd consecutive title for the Eagles and their 8th title since 2015. The program has not lost a game in Massachusetts in the last 3 seasons and is the clear team to beat in the state. "We're really proud of these guys," BC High head coach Paul Carty said. "They've leveled up. They've really leveled up and set the bar higher for us." Dottie?
Thanks, Bob. And now a word from Howie Carr. D.A. Ryan takes transparency to new low. Excuse me. The word of the day is transparency. Just ask the 71-year-old district attorney of Middlesex County, Marion Ryan. The wrinkly Democrat with the M.O. Howard Three Stooges haircut never stops babbling about how transparent she and her office are. Oddly, though, Whenever Marion isn't talking about how transparent she is, she's desperately trying to stop any transparency about the alleged drunk driving motor vehicle homicide by one of her top state police investigators, the second generation hack state trooper Scott Quigley. Nothing to see here, folks, at least until after the primary election, September 1st. The fatal OUI accident involving one of her troopers happened in December 2023. Nobody found out about it until January 2026. That's a long time to cover up a fatal MV by an allegedly drunk cop in Marion Ryan's office. Imagine how long Sergeant Quigley's alleged 114 BAC could have been kept under the rug if she weren't so darned transparent. How transparent is she, you ask? When she's not stonewalling the Quigley homicide investigation? At the top of the DA's X feed, this is her proud brag. I quote, "Striving every day to be the most dedicated, most effective, most transparent, and most innovative public prosecutor's office in the United States." End of quote. When she went back to her alma mater, Emmanuel College, she told the co-eds, "We have to be willing to examine our own work and be fully transparent." She said that in 2024. The same year, Quigley returned to work after killing the guy by crossing a double yellow line after a reported long liquid afternoon at a local tavern. For killing a poor guy in a disabled transport van, Quigley received a, I quote, "warning." Then he was promoted to sergeant. It's all about transparency, you know. As recently as April Fool's Day, appropriately enough, Ryan issued a press release touting how something or other was consistent with District Attorney Ryan's commitment to full transparency. And yet, she's totally stonewalling the release of any information about her pet Quigley's MV homicide. Of course, she has her reasons. The investigation continues. Stop me if you've heard this one before. She can't release the audio or the transcripts of her interviews with the hack ex-judge that she paid $20,000 because the investigation continues. Her comrades in the state police refused to release the other seven, count them, seven auto accidents that Quigley was involved in. Repeat after me. The investigation continues. What Ryan and the other co-conspirators are trying to do is drag their feet until she can vanquish her former top ADA, a straight arrow named David Solit, in the Democratic primary. So it's continuance after continuance, followed by the inevitable form letter. "Sorry, we'd like to help you, but the investigation continues." In addition to her commitment to transparency, Marion Ryan has one other adage that she lives by. quote, "Do as I say, not as I do," end of quote. Whenever it comes to doing anything about anything other than pointing the finger at somebody else, Ryan is MIA. Whenever she's asked why she doesn't do something, she throws up her liver-spotted hands and whines, "I don't have the authority." Or a cop does something that the community objects to. Instead of doing the right thing and telling the activists that the cop didn't do anything wrong, she punts to a judicial inquest. That means that some judge is going to have to take the heat from the Monica Cannon Grant types when he does the right thing. Or, if the judicial inquest gag isn't appropriate, she may take a weak case to trial and let the jury handle the acquittal. Anything so she doesn't have to accept responsibility for an unpopular decision. The local polls and cops all have their own alibis for not locking up criminals. They can't cooperate with ICE because sanctuary laws, or the parole board has to let dozens of convicted killers out of prison because the SJC made some lunatic decision. But Marion Ryan has taken looking the other way to a whole new level, as proven by the Scott Quigley cover-up, which, of course, she says is totally not her fault. It never is. I asked Michael Mahoney, the attorney for the estate of the poor man killed by Ryan's pal, how long it took him to get even the most basic facts. "It took me 13 months to even get Quigley's name out of them," he said, "and then another 7 months to get his blood alcohol level from the hospital." Transparency. That's what it's all about for Marion Ryan. Just to give you another example, the Ponzo brothers, the crooked ex-cops from Stoneham, who just got out of federal prison after stealing $40 million in state funds from the Mass Saves boondoggle. The whistleblower who turned in the mega fraudsters first went to, you guessed it, the Middlesex County DA's office. He was only turning them in on the embezzlement of $27,000 in police union funds. But Marion Ryan's minions gave it a good leaving alone. So the whistleblower then went to the feds and told them about both the small local grift and the big Mass Saves ripoff. You can read all about the sequence of events in the Fed's sentencing memo last year on the two crooked cop brothers. In an amazing coincidence, someone who might have been peripherally embarrassed by the Ponzo's open and gross thievery just happened to be related to a local Democrat politician. But surely those hack ties could not have possibly played a role in Ryan's decision to take a pass on a slam dunk corruption case. That wouldn't have been very transparent, would it? Meanwhile, Quigley remains free as a bird almost 3 years after killing the guy in the disabled van. And Marion Ryan is saying, hey, don't blame me. I was in the dark about it, just like everybody else. In a letter to the state police last February, Marion Ryan was very transparent about claiming she knew nothing for all those 25 months while the guy, now indicted, was being promoted to sergeant. We recently learned the state police did not notify this office, was also not notified, nor were we told. If I ever get jammed up, I just hope it happens in a county with a prosecutor as transparent as Marion Ryan. The investigation continues. Bob?
Thank you, Dottie. Our next article, subtitled or under the subheading Beacon Hill, Unions in Uproar Over Plans to Tap Pension Fund. This is by Tim Dunn. Unions and fiscal watchdogs are in an uproar over a proposed bill filed by Governor Maura Healey that would tap the state's pension system to the tune of $50 million to $100 million to fund economic development grants across Massachusetts. In a letter from both the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, Local 509, and the National Association of Government Employees, NAGE, sent in an email to the Herald and dated June 3rd, the organizations urged Ely to change a section of the legislation allowing the state's pension system to be utilized to fund economic development grants, expressing their firm opposition to the provision. While this initiative offers many promising ideas to spark and support economic development in Massachusetts, it is both unwise and illegal to utilize the state's pension system as a stored source of grant funding for those initiatives. And our collective organizations stand in firm opposition to the inclusion of this provision in legislation that may reach your desk, the co-signed letter to Healey reads. The legislation called the Mass Wins Act, H. 5386, would require the Pension Reserves Investment Management, PRIM, board to commit between $50 million and $100 million to be used for grants supporting economic development initiatives under Section 104. Notwithstanding any other general or special law to the contrary, the Pension Reserves Investment Management Board established under Section 23 of Chapter 32 of the General Laws shall commit not less than $50 million and not more than $100 million in a fund or fund of funds established in Massachusetts for the benefit of early stage or growth stage companies domiciled or having a significant operating presence in the Commonwealth, Section 104 of Healey's bill states. This section of the legislation would essentially create an exemption to the longstanding guidelines of the PRIM board works off of when determining how and where to invest using state pension reserves. Furthermore, there is no clear indication in the legislation that the money would even be returned to the pension fund. There does not appear to be any mechanism to return the original principal to the pension fund, let alone a reasonable return on investment. The PRIM board already has the authority to make economic investments that support development in Massachusetts. This proposed fund would duplicate those efforts without the governance, oversight, and stewardship currently provided by the PRIM board, SEIU and NAGE added in their letter to Healey. But the governor's office and the Executive Office of Economic Development refute the union's take on the bill, saying that it does not transfer the pension funds to economic development grant-making purposes. Quote, the proposal contemplates a market rate investment in a new professionally managed fund with a focus on Massachusetts companies. The intent is to generate returns for beneficiaries while supporting innovation and economic growth in the Commonwealth. A spokesman for the Executive Office of Economic Development told the Herald, adding that Section 104 does not exempt PRIM from its existing obligations or standards. The administration appreciates the feedback provided by NAGE and will continue discussions with them, they said. The legislation was last taken up by the Joint Committee on Economic Development and Emerging Technologies in a hearing on May 19th, where representatives from the governor's office spoke in favor of the bill. The committee has until July 18th to vote on whether to kill or advance the legislation. But the unions aren't the only organizations against the idea of using state pension funds to cover the costs of economic development grants with fiscal watchdog, the Massachusetts Fiscal Alliance, also chiming in on Beacon Hill's, quote, fiscal irresponsibility, end quote. After years of massive growth in state spending and increasing reliance on one-time revenues and budget maneuvers, it's troubling to see Beacon Hill now looking to pension assets as their next tool to paper over their fiscal irresponsibility, Mass Fiscal Executive Director Paul Craney told the Herald in a written statement. The state's pension system exists to serve retirees, not as a venture capital fund for politicians. Investment decisions should be based on maximizing returns for beneficiaries, not on what projects state officials want to promote, he said. Pioneer Institute for Public Policy Research is echoing the same call, saying the governor should not be directing money from the state's pension fund toward preferred companies. The state's pension fund is not an economic development program. The state owes taxpayers and retirees the best risk-adjusted returns possible. Pioneer Institute COO Mary Knoston told the Herald. It should invest its pension assets based on sound financial judgment, not direct them toward preferred companies or limit investments by geography. Dottie?
Thanks, Bob. And now from the Herald opinion page, the editorial. Washington is hemorrhaging taxpayer cash. Government has never been known as a model of efficiency. Yet, a new report from the Government Accountability Office should make even the most hardened cynic blanch. Last week, the GAO revealed that the federal government lost at least $186 billion to, I quote, improper payments in fiscal 2025. That's up by $24 billion from the previous fiscal year. An improper payment is defined as one that should not have been made or that was made in an incorrect amount, including overpayments and underpayments. Astonishingly, the GAO calculates that executive branch agencies have reported cumulative improper payment estimates of about $3 trillion since fiscal year 2003. That's more than 7.5% of the entire soaring national debt. Now, we're talking real money. In the understatement of the year, the GAO noted that improper payments are a long-standing, significant problem in the federal government. A GAO letter to Congress suggests it is imperative that agencies prioritize reducing improper payments. This, in and of itself, is an argument for shrinking the Beltway behemoth. The larger the administrative state becomes, and the more Washington bleeds from the private sector, the more taxpayer money that is inevitably squandered. Putting that aside, however, the report reveals that six federal agencies, the Corporation for National and Community Service, along with the Department of Agriculture, Labor, Treasury, Veterans Affairs, and Health and Human Services, have estimated improper payment rates of 10% or higher for at least three consecutive years. Medicare and Medicaid account for about half of all improper payments. Other programs on the high-risk list include unemployment insurance payments and the earned income tax credit. A 2019 law deems programs that exceed a 10% improper payment threshold for consecutive years as non-compliant and mandates they inform the Office of Management and Budget in Congress. Yet, five of the seven agencies deemed non-compliant after fiscal 2025 did not have sufficient documented policies and procedures to ensure consistent, timely reporting for their non-compliant programs. That means Congress is left in the dark regarding which programs continue to pose elevated risks and whether agencies are taking meaningful steps to address them. This is unacceptable. Congress must ensure that agencies are transparent and actively working to get improper payment rates down to zero. If this is too big a burden for bureaucracies to bear, Congress should take a machete to their budgets until they show they can responsibly handle the money with which they are entrusted. Bob?
Thank you, Dottie. Now we'll turn to the opinion page under the subheading Property Taxes. Rent control, a tax hike on Massachusetts homeowners. And this is Paul Diego Craney and Gerald Walczak. Paul Diego Craney is Executive Director of the Fiscal Alliance Foundation, and Gerald Walczak is President of the Walczak Policy Consulting. At a time when Massachusetts residents are already struggling with high housing costs, a new proposal threatens to make things worse in a way many homeowners may not expect. Rent control is often framed as a policy aimed at helping renters, but a new study from the Fiscal Alliance Foundation finds that it would also raise property taxes on homeowners across the Commonwealth. The reason is straightforward. Property taxes in Massachusetts are driven by local budgets, not fixed rates. When the value of one category of property declines, the tax burden does not disappear, it shifts. Under a rent control system, the value of rental housing falls. It is a function of how property is assessed. Rental properties are valued based on the income they generate. When government caps that income, property values decline accordingly. The proposed rent control ballot question would be the most aggressive in the nation. Massachusetts would be the fourth state in the nation to adopt the policy and the first on the East Coast. Under the ballot question proposal, the mandate applies statewide with no municipal opt-out, caps annual rent increases at the lesser of inflation or 5%, and contains no vacancy decontrol mechanism. Locking in 2026 rental prices as the baseline in perpetuity for existing properties. Our study estimates that rent control would reduce rental property values by more than 30% over time. That translates to a significant drop in the share of property taxes paid by those properties. To make up the difference, unless municipalities make budget cuts, taxes are shifted onto other property owners, including homeowners, via higher mill levies. The mill levy, which is the tax rate, applied to a property's assessed value to calculate local property taxes, rises automatically to maintain the level of revenue necessary to fund the budget. These increases are not constrained by Proposition 2.5, since the levy increases are intended only to maintain current collection levels. The result is higher tax bills for people who do not benefit from rent control at all. Statewide, the median homeowner would see an increase of about $312 per year in property taxes, even as the value of their home declines, with rent control degrading community quality as maintenance and investments dry up. Had these effects been present for the last 10 years, the median home's cumulative property tax burden would have been almost $2,600 higher over the past decade. Over the life of a typical mortgage, that adds up to nearly $19,000 in an additional tax burden. The burden would fall heaviest on urban communities with large rental populations. In Boston, the average homeowner would pay more than $1,100 each year, extra each year, while in cities like Lowell and Worcester, tax increases could approach or exceed 10%. These outcomes are not unique to Massachusetts. They are consistent with what has happened in other jurisdictions. In Portland, Maine, rent control led to a measurable decline in property values and a corresponding shift in tax burdens onto homeowners. In St. Paul, Minnesota, property values dropped sharply within months of adopting rent control, while new housing construction slowed dramatically. In Cambridge, rent control depressed rental properties' values by as much as 50% before voters ultimately repealed the policy. The pattern is clear. Rent control reduces the value of rental housing, discourages investment, and shrinks the tax base. When that happens, homeowners are left to pick up the tab. Supporters of rent control often argue that it is necessary to address housing affordability, but policy that discourages new housing construction and degrade existing housing stock only make the problem worse over time. Limiting supply while increasing demand is a recipe for higher prices, not lower ones. There is also a fairness issue. Studies consistently show that its benefits are skewed toward higher income tenants who are better positioned to remain in controlled units over time. An analysis of Massachusetts prior experience with rent control concluded that people of color occupied only 12% of rent-controlled properties, despite representing 24% of residents in rent-controlled cities, and that the benefits of rent control disproportionately flowed to higher-income tenants. Massachusetts has tried rent control before, and voters rejected it more than three decades ago. The evidence since then, both here and elsewhere, has only strengthened the case against it. For homeowners across the Commonwealth, the bottom line is simple. Rent control is not just a housing policy. It is a tax increase. It is one they will be asked to pay. Dottie?
Thanks, Bob. Untouchable judge pleads not guilty. Accused of domestic violence by Colleen Cronin. A Cape Cod district court judge pleaded not guilty to domestic violence charges at his arraignment at Brighton District Court yesterday morning. Judge Robert A. Welsh III, 60, was released on his own personal recognizance after entering his plea for one count each of assault and battery with a dangerous weapon on a person 60 or older and assault and battery on a family or household member. Welsh, who is an Orleans District Court judge, has been placed on administrative duties, meaning that he cannot hear cases, but he is still being paid. He declined to speak with the press following the arraignment. According to a probable cause affidavit and court records, Welsh allegedly grabbed the victim, whose name is redacted, and kicked her in the vagina while he had a shoe on at the end of January 2025. The alleged assault happened in Sandwich. The victim had contacted the Cape and Islands District Attorney, Robert Galloboy, earlier this year and asked for a meeting without stating the reason, according to the affidavit written by State Police Detective Lieutenant Kevin McDermott. She told the DA and McDermott that Welsh grabbed her by her arms and squeezed so tightly that she had to bite him to get him to let go, McDermott wrote. McDermott wrote that the victim showed him photos of the bruising and swelling on her arm. The victim also explained that Welsh had kicked her, then showed a photo just to Galloboy of the bruising on her vagina. During the May 4th meeting with the DA and lieutenant, the victim also described an earlier incident when Welsh had allegedly thrown her on the ground during a trip to Las Vegas on 2021. Police were called, the victim told them, but she didn't press charges. The victim reported that Welsh was intoxicated during both incidents, that he was often drunk, even showing up to work hungover, and that when drinking alcohol, he becomes more easily aggravated, McDermott wrote. Judge Welsh would consistently tell her that he was untouchable because he was a judge, he added. She also told them that what she was telling them should not be shared and that she wasn't contacting them to be vindictive, the affidavit said. Even though the incident occurred on the Cape, the Chief Justice of the state courts changed the venue to Brighton. Welsh comes from a long line of judges in the region. Both his father and grandfather, who have the same name, sat on the bench. The incident was initially reported as happening earlier this year, but was amended by a Suffolk County prosecutor's motion to 2025. Welsh will be back in court July 14th. On a happier note, Pfeiffer Fan Festival opens today by Lance Reynolds. The FIFA Fan Festival is set to open at Boston City Hall Plaza today, but officials say soccer fans who are looking to get in at the door will have to go elsewhere to watch the World Cup. The festivities are already sold out, and tomorrow, according to officials. A Boston Mayor, Michelle Wu, is encouraging fans to try to grab a spot for the other 14 days of the festival through June 27th. At the same time, she recommends people interested in the excitement to start planning to attend alternative watch parties. I also want to be clear that for all of this, throughout the entire time, safety is our number one priority, Wu said. We want FanFest to be fun and welcoming for everyone, so please just be mindful of increased pedestrian traffic around City Hall. Make a plan for how to get here and register online in advance if you want to attend FanFest. Because of capacity and because of such interest, the mayor added, registration doesn't guarantee entry if the plaza reaches capacity. Nearly 150,000 fans have already registered to attend the Fan Festival, said Mike Loynette, the president and CEO of the Boston Soccer 2026 Nonprofit Host Committee. He noted that capacity is set to 5,000 fans at any one time. Bob?
Thank you, Dottie. And turning to the Biz Smart section of today's Herald, take a look at the Market Watch. Dow Jones was up 1.86% to 50,848.75. S&P 500 was up 1.75% to 7,394.30. And the NASDAQ was up 2.54% to 25,809.66. And the lead article under the subheading Markets, SpaceX poised to make history. $75 billion stock IPO will be the biggest ever and could make Elon Musk a trillionaire. And this is from the Los Angeles Times. SpaceX is poised to make history SpaceX is poised to make history on with a record-setting IPO that will catapult the once-fledgling aerospace startup into one of the most valuable companies on Earth. The company, founded in 2002, is selling at least 555 million shares at $135 apiece, which could raise $75 billion or more. That could give Elon Musk's rocket communications and AI company a valuation of at least $1.77 trillion. The IPO would be the largest on record, by far eclipsing the 2019 offering by Saudi Arabia's state-owned oil giant Saudi Aramco, which raised $29.4 billion. It could also make Musk, whose net worth is now pegged at $707 billion by Bloomberg, the world's first trillionaire, given his other holdings in Tesla. Some investors and industry analysts wonder whether SpaceX might be overvalued and questioned a governance structure that puts Musk firmly in control of the company and its board of directors. However, demand for the shares being sold by nearly two dozen investment banks is so high that the offering is said to be oversubscribed by at least three times by big institutions. That means investors are buying into Musk's vision for the company as a leader in rocketry, internet communications, and artificial intelligence. SpaceX's Falcon 9 is the world's dominant launch vehicle, and the company is developing Starship, a massive rocket that will send astronauts to the moon and possibly Mars, while supporting the build-out of the company's Starlink satellite internet communication system. Musk also envisions a network of orbiting AI satellite data centers, and the company has purchased spectrum to build a satellite-based mobile communications network. Most important for investors wanting to ride the AI wave, Musk merged his XAI artificial intelligence company into SpaceX this year. The company already has built large AI data centers and has leased AI compute capacity to Anthropic and Google. And I see we've come to the end of our time with you. And so I will read today's horoscope. If today's your birthday, June 12th, happy birthday. And here is your horoscope. It's your year of powerful wielding when you channel your personal influence and electricity in life-changing directors. Energies like fame, competition, and desire will be managed to brilliant effect. More highlights, the things you're doing that you've done for years will start to pay you much more, and new works ignites early on. Also, a sweet reunion and a domestic transformation. Cancer and Aquarius adore you, and your lucky numbers are 49, 33, 12, 5, and 8. This has been Bob.
And Dottie.
Reading from the June 12th edition of the Boston Herald, we thank you so much for listening, and we wish you a fantastic Friday, and stay cool.